Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Nicholas Frickman, author of the book The Bloody Flag, Mutiny in the Age of the Atlantic Revolutions. Nicholas, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you, Mark. I'm very, very happy to be here and have this opportunity to talk about my new book.
And we're very happy to have you on the podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
I'm currently an assistant professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh, which is also where I got my PhD and where I wrote the original dissertation that then now a long time later became this book. My background, as anyone will hear, I'm not a native English speaker. I have a funny muddled accent. I was born in Sweden, but grew up in Germany and then went to undergraduate in the UK and then graduate school in the US. So I think I have a muddled set of accents all piled on top of each other.
I think it was more cosmopolitan, and it's a fascinating background because I can, you know, hearing it makes me think about what your book, embodies, which is this, it's not a history of any one nation or any one navy, but it's a very cosmopolitan history. What was it that led you to write a book about mutinies during the Atlantic Revolutionary, during the Revolutionary period, and why did you adopt the focus that you did?
It's something I've obviously thought about a lot that I think all of us do when we choose and get fascinated by a particular topic. In my case, in some ways, it's especially weird because where I grew up in Germany is almost as landlocked as you can be anywhere in Western Europe. It was literally the last village before the Swiss border. And yet there was always something about the sea and ships and especially the age of sail that I just found basically just romantic and fascinating. But when I first went to graduate school, having grown up in Germany, I wanted to do something actually on the Nazi period, a kind of labor history of Nazi Germany, since that just seemed to me something that still just has to be understood. There are too many open questions still. But as I started reading around and tried to educate myself in labor history and the historiography, I happened to bump into my future advisor's first book, Marcus Rediker's Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea, and I was just blown away. I didn't realize you could be a historian of pirates and that whole world. And I was like, what? You can do that? So at that point, I just basically just threw out all the Nazi stuff, and I just decided I was going to study 18th century sailors. And then a few years, I did my MA in the UK, and I did it part-time. So a lot of times, just read around and educate myself, and I stumbled into the British Marxist historical tradition, E.P. Thompson, of course, Christopher Hill. This whole world opened up to me, and then eventually applied for grad school in the U.S. to study with Marcus Rediker in Pittsburgh. And as then came time to decide on a topic, it was clear to me that I wanted to do something on sailors in the late 18th century. But the kind of question that had bugged me, that initially had driven me to this question on Nazi Germany, kind of was still there. Like, I still wanted to understand the sort of the force of nationalism and how it interacts with class. Since there was this well-established literature on the cosmopolitanism of 18th century sailors, I wondered how that cosmopolitanism fared once it was confronted with what the literature tells us is a sort of key moment in the emergence of modern nationalism, the sort of great cycle of French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. So the initial idea when this project started a long, long time ago was to see how that maritime cosmopolitanism fractures and how sailors, I assumed, would adopt nationalist solidarities or at least prioritize those over their sort of class-based cosmopolitan solidarities. I thought from the beginning, if I want to try to understand how this cosmopolitan multinational world shatters into national units, I couldn't just study it from the perspective of one nation or imperial space, because that seemed to predetermine the outcome. I would start with the fractured or the sort of the piece that had broken out of the whole. So given my particular own biographical background, I had a few languages that kind of had assembled over the years. I grew up speaking Swedish and German as a child, Swedish with my family, German outside of the home. I lived briefly in the Netherlands, so I knew how to speak and read Dutch. I'd had French in school. Obviously, I spoke English. As a native Swedish speaker, I can read Danish and Norwegian fairly easily. So I tried to assemble as many of these languages as possible to try and recreate this multinational space of the Atlantic. But of course, whenever you go beyond one national unit, you get problems because you can't do everything and you somehow have to justify your selection. And I do feel that not having included, for instance, Spain and the Spanish Navy, the Russian Navy, the Ottoman Navy is a problem, but there's only so much you can do, obviously. So in the end, what I do in the book, I focus on the British Navy, the French Navy, and the Dutch Navy primarily, and also look a little bit at the United States and at Sweden in during the 1790s. I sort of start with that as my kind of sample and see what happens in those navies. And why mutinies? That actually was sort of initially just a practical matter. I thought, well, as a sort of, there's a tradition of basically looking at court records to get the bottom-up perspective of ordinary people. So I figured that would be a place where I could find the voices of ordinary sailors who get in trouble and who have to explain themselves. Once I started looking at it, I just found so many mutinies that the project kind of shifted to studying mutinies themselves rather than this initial question. So that's kind of how I stumbled into this.
It's that's one of the things that fascinated me as I was reading about was the sheer number of them, because you know, so many of the histories, and I'm not a specialist, so I have not read too deeply into the area, but I mean, there are certain famous episodes, such as the Spithead Mutiny in 1797, but the sheer number that you identify really illustrate how it's this perennial issue that's of great concern, that we're not talking about the Horatio Hornblower, happy and diligent crew here, that there are a lot of crews in this during this period, of the 1790s, where there's a lot of turmoil reflecting both the ship dynamics, the hierarchy, the tensions there, but also what's going on in the broader world with revolutionary ideals, the notion of the citizenship of man, and this idea that you describe of these sailors who have a very who had this very radical concept that maybe ships should be governed differently, that maybe we should have a different way of making decisions in how we operate, given that we're in this new world, this new era of the empowerment of man.
Yeah, I mean, I was really blown away just by the sheer number of mutinies. And as you say, like I knew, of course, of a few. I'd heard of Spithead and the Nore. There's of course the Bounty, which is just preceding this this period, but I had no idea it would be that many. And but of course, once you start thinking about it, and then once you start looking at them, it kind of becomes obvious why there would be. Again, we have, or before this book, I build on a lot of writing that shows that sailors were central political agents throughout Atlantic history, but especially during the Age of Revolution. So in that sense, it shouldn't be surprising. Then, of course, with these particular naval sailors, they also, they are sent into this very, very long war in beginning of the 1790s. That comes at the tail end of about 40 years of an intense build-up and an intense naval arms race where empires are under intense pressure to cut costs and then to increase efficiencies, which, of course, I mean a change in working relations and put pressure on conditions on board ships. So on top of that, we have a reason for discontent aboard ship. And then comes this just extraordinary explosion of political radicalism in every country, literally every country around the Atlantic Rim. So it would should not surprise us that sailors join wholeheartedly in this project. And of course, what to me became especially interesting as I started looking at it was also sort of to realize, and I'd never thought about this before, that sailors literally were the people, and particularly naval sailors, who held these seaborne empires together. There's a lot of space between Britain and Jamaica, a lot of space between France and Saint-Domingue, and that space is bridged by sailors. It's especially sailors on board warships that hold these empires together. And that, of course, lent particular significance to these radical movements on board ship, because they literally threatened the networks that held together these imperial entities and the imperial economies that propped up those empires. On the one hand, I was completely surprised, but then also once I started to think about it, I was questioning why I was so surprised, really.
What I found especially interesting was you're describing this common dynamic that's taking place in the 1790s, but it's not coming from a common context. One of the first things you do in your book is you describe how these navies are put together. And while there are certain broad similarities, such as there's a preference for having people in these navies who have a sailing background, the recruitment practices, the retention practices are often very different. I was wondering if you could perhaps give us a brief overview of the composition of these different navies, how they recruit their sailors, and how that helped to set the stage for some of the discontent that you describe in the book.
Certainly. Yeah, I think there are very significant differences, which then do come out as the sort of tensions begin to rise. But one thing first to note, which I think is important to realize, that by the late 18th century, almost the entire Western European coastline, or the people living along the entire European coastline, were under some form of obligation to serve the state in wartime. This was unique, that type of geographical requirement on people to offer up their labor to the state. Armies recruited themselves quite differently in different ways across the continent. The one exception is the Dutch Republic, and I can talk about that in a second. So everywhere coming out of the Middle Ages into the modern period, forms of coercive recruitment developed all along the coastline. Now, the most famous one, of course, is the British, which is impressment, which in some ways, even though there were institutional changes along the way that made the system more effective, but it essentially remained unchanged from the medieval period when it first developed. And this simply was a system of just literally grabbing people off ships or targeting places on shore where likely sailors would gather, and just grabbing them and forcing them on board ships. So it was a form of large-scale state-sanctioned kidnapping of maritime labor, essentially. France initially operated a form of impressment into the late 17th century, but then instituted a number of reforms and developed a highly sophisticated conscription system under which every man of working age living along the coast and certain navigable rivers had to register their name with a recruitment agent. And then in return for getting certain benefits like invalid insurance or payment for widows and things like that, and also exemption from certain taxes and other duties, they would be expected to serve every few years during peacetime and when called up during wartime. So this was kind of a, and this was for the time late 17th and 18th century, it was a highly efficient bureaucratic system. But of course, the bureaucratic networks were not as efficient then as they would eventually become in the 19th and 20th century. So the French had a much harder time recruiting sailors than the British, who just used brute force. For most of the 18th century, the French and then other the Spanish and the Scandinavian navies had modified version of this sort of French conscription system. Discontent was lower in the French Navy than in the British Navy, and I think in part the reason was that that the recruitment was more mutually beneficial, even if people still resented it. At least they got some benefits out of it, whereas in the British it was literally just being forced to serve for low wages on board warships. Now, the Dutch were interesting because they unique among all the major navies, used no directly coercive recruitment. They instead outsourced it to a system of private labor brokers and what's often referred to as crimps. And what they did was that they would basically, sort of the bottom layer of this Dutch system was a network of tavern keepers in Dutch port cities who would invite in people who looked like sailors. They would offer them room and board and entertainment on credit. And once they'd run up a debt, they would then facilitate the entrance of these sailors into either a warship or a Dutch East India ship, and would then be paid the advance that the sailor would normally get. They would be paid that by the Navy to make up the debt the sailor had accumulated. Also, in terms of the Dutch being unusual, was that historically the Dutch, they reserved the worst jobs in the Republic, and this definitely included service in the Navy to foreign migrants. So in the Dutch Navy in the late 18th century, anywhere between 70-90% of a given crew was not born in the Netherlands itself. The Dutch drew primarily from the sort of core areas of the Holy Roman Empire, a lot of Germans, Bohemians, Hungarians, and so forth. In terms of composition, in terms of national background, the French were among the large navies the most homogenous. Here, somewhere between 20 and 30% were foreign-born, so somewhere around 70 to 80% were native French-born. And the British were somewhere in the middle. They were, an average ship was perhaps 50% English-born, 20% Irish, and the rest from all over the world. So they were, in various degrees, they were highly cosmopolitan, the sort of Dutch at the far end, the French at the less cosmopolitan end, and all were recruited more or less through direct coercion. So even the Dutch cases was ultimately a sort of exploitation of poverty and using the sort of structural force of poverty to push people into a highly disagreeable a work situation.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's an interesting series of systems that you described. The thing I find fascinating about the Dutch is how it's very capitalistic. You don't have that monarchy, traditional feudal, post-feudal society that you're talking about, where there's the hierarchy and you respect the order. It's much more oriented towards, well, we don't quite have that. We have this business system, but you nonetheless have this notion of people that are in to a degree, it's forced servitude. It's not quite slavery, but it's in some ways it's a little indistinguishable. And yet then you have in the 1790s this explosion of enthusiasm about equality and fraternity and this creates this really fascinating social dynamic that you describe in your book. So how do the ships start to reflect what's going on with the French Revolution, what's going on with a lot of the rhetoric that's coming out of the Enlightenment, and what is it that's leading them to take this extremely drastic step towards mutiny, knowing what mutiny entails, potentially?
I mentioned this, that I think it's in the conclusion of the book. It was one of my favorite finds in the archive. And, you know, you have like any sort of project, you have like a few which just sort of stick with you. And you were so happy when you found it. In this case, it was a petition that French sailors wrote in 93 or 94, I forget. And then one of the slogans they put on this petition, the petition was basically for shore leave. They wanted to get off the boat and then be on shore and then be with their families and friends and so forth. And on the petition, they put the slogan, liberty or death, which, of course, was a very common revolutionary slogan of the era. But I suddenly realized that it also had this much deeper meaning for the sailors, because liberty was what sailors traditionally used when they spoke about shore leave. So that when they talked about that they want liberty, one meaning was for them to get off the boat and be on shore. The flip side to that, the second part of that slogan, liberty or death, was also profoundly meaningful for them, because sailors suffered spectacularly high mortality rates from disease. Far more sailors died from disease than from combat or any other kind of injury. And the numbers are really staggering. So for many sailors who were sent to do duty in the West Indies, for instance, the chances were very, very high that they would not return, that they simply would be killed by yellow fever or malaria. So this demand, liberty or death, had a very literal meaning for them. It's like liberty, get off the boat, or death, because otherwise there's a very high chance that they actually going to die. So this was to me sort of a key insight when I realized this, that sailors had a sort of an material existence. This is certainly true for other population groups too, but I mean, my concern, of course, was the sailors, that these types of sort of grand political slogans, they're filled in with people's with meanings that are derived from people's material conditions. And in the case of the sailors, it was particularly stark. This was one instance. Also, you look at simply the kind of political micro society that is created on board ship. It's the purest form of tyranny imaginable. All power flows from the single figure of the captain, and all power flows downward formally. Those who are at the bottom or the receiving end of authority are formally completely disempowered. Of course, there's always resistance. There's ways of getting around and so forth. And there's everyday negotiation happening. But formally, it's a pure tyranny. So again, when this sort of
quickly, there's a point that you make in your book that probably would help for some context, is that what you're describing here is not necessarily the norm when you're talking about the civilian merchant practice. There you describe a more of a tradition of cooperation. The crew is part of the process. They profit from it, and of course they're far better remunerated for it. So what you're describing here is not just a sense of a hierarchy that, you know, where they just suddenly discovered that they were knowing that they could be doing better. It's that they have this contrast that really helps to illustrate for them this idea that, wow, we really have it terrible. It's not just an abstract notion of maybe we should have liberty. There's this real world example of, well, in the merchant marine, which many of these sailors come from, it operates very differently and arguably more successfully too.
The question of success is hard to sort of judge, because I mean the Royal Navy was extremely successful, not for the sailors in it, but as sort of an imperial institution that did its job. But I think, the point you make is critical and extremely important. There is a kind of fake debate in Atlantic maritime history, whether conditions on board ship were really horrible and oppressive, or whether they were relatively egalitarian. And the reason I call it a fake debate is that often people engage in this don't take into account that the maritime labor market had many different sectors. It is certainly true that there were sectors that were extremely exploitative and authoritarian, including the Navy and including deep sea shipping. That is, ships that crossed the Atlantic tended to be have very, very poor working conditions and then very, very exploited workers. But those sailors were a minority of sailors working the Atlantic. The majority sailed out of relatively small ports on small ships with relatively flat hierarchies. They lived in the same communities on board ship as they lived on shore. So the crews would be recruited locally. They would know each other. The authority of the captain on board ship would be checked by communal disapproval on shore if he would become too brutal or exceed what was accepted as a sort of bounds of his authority and so forth. Now, those two sectors were kept relatively distinct until the middle of the 18th century, but because the size of navies mushroomed beginning in the 1740s, there was an intense hunt for more and more maritime labor, and more people began to migrate from the what can be thought of as sort of coastal or riverine shipping into deep sea shipping. So there were more and more people who were socialized into a world of relatively egalitarian hierarchies at sea, into these harshly hierarchical and authoritarian situations, both in the in deep sea merchant shipping, but especially in the Navy, which was really extreme when it came to the hierarchies and the violence with which they were enforced on board ship. And one of the arguments that I make in the book is that it's a sort of combination of the experience of those hierarchies and of the authoritarianism and how they become interpreted, and then how the language of radical republicanism that is spreading around the revolutionary Atlantic, how sailors take that on to interpret their own conditions. And that is given additional force by the influx of people who have experienced a different form of being on board ship, a much more egalitarian form. And it's kind of those two streams of political experience that come together and lay the basis for this huge wave of ever more radical mutinies that we see unfolding during the 1790s.
I was wondering if you could describe maybe one or two of these mutinies that you think are particularly symbolic or representative of this dynamic that you're talking about. Can you give us a sense as to what were some of the immediate causes and how these mutinies unfolded? Were they simply slaughtering the officers and then becoming pirates? Were they trying to appeal to a higher authority over the heads of the captains? Or were they abandoning their allegiance and trying to seek some freedom elsewhere?
So with that, so one of the things I discovered is that there's a whole sort of typology of different types of mutiny, but also that initially each navy has sort of a different pattern of how people mutiny, but those patterns and the sort of waves tend to flow together and harmonize towards the end of the 1790s when the type of mutiny you described here at the end is sort of much more violent, the sort of rising up, overthrowing the power of the officer, sometimes killing them, and then just sort of disappearing over the horizon. That becomes very prominent at the end of the decade when the sort of conflict between officers and crews has really become extremely bitter on both sides. But before that, it starts differently in each navy. So in the French Navy, there's a kind of combination. On the one hand, once state authority collapses at the beginning of the revolution, there's a real sense of joy of crews just testing the boundaries and just saying no for the sheer fun of it. That they know, because that these officers are by and large were aristocratic. They had no authority anymore. So there's a kind of it's sometimes quite just funny to sort of see how sailors, just because they can, say no now. So it really becomes kind of anarchic. But what's fascinating in the French case is that that those types of anarchic mutinies, they tend to only happen when crews are in home waters. So when they anchor off Brest or Toulon or Rochefort, they don't tend to happen in the colonies. And in the colonies, those same sort of chaotic anarchic sailors, they display a sort of profound sense of political responsibility. You can sort of see in how they mutiny and to how, whom they appeal and how confused they are that they try to work out who has authority over them. They have a strong sense that they're now serving the French Republic at sea, and this includes the French Republic's colonies overseas, but they're not quite sure who has the right to make decisions and who has the right to give them orders. Pretty quickly, it appears that it's no longer the established military hierarchy, because that was established under the old regime. So that becomes, they disregard that quite soon. Instinctively, the sailors tend to give priority to local authorities on shore. So the municipalities in the particular port city they find themselves in. And that works well when they're in France. But in the colonies, it becomes difficult because there are all the issues or local politics are intersected with the politics of slavery and the politics of race. And the sailors, by and large, instinctively side with people who are like themselves, that is poor white people in the port towns. But they rub against the racism of those people in the colonies. So they're torn back and forth, and they don't know who's sort of lead to follow. And that in the French Navy has the effect that ultimately they fall back upon themselves, that they sort of resurrect the age-old traditions that when in crisis, ultimately those who decide over ship are the ship's crew. And they begin over time to sort of articulate a political theory to justify that when there's a crisis situation, it's the crew that decides collectively. So that's kind of the French predominant form of mutiny. The Dutch, in part because they're so multinational, their mutinies tend to just be chaotic. They erupt and they want to run away. So there's relatively little sort of sophisticated political content among Dutch mutineers. The British case, here mutinies develop essentially as strikes. And then it's fascinating over the first few years of the war to sort of see how the form of mutiny develops among British sailors, that what they do from the beginning is that they go on strike. And what that means is that they barricade themselves below deck. They just say, we're not going to work and we're not going to come up on deck until our demands are met. The officers, of course, strike back, ultimately with violence. And then very quickly, what one historian, Jonathan Neal, has described as an armed strike develops. So the typical mutiny then in the British Navy gets a sort of particular type of formula, which is that in the middle of the night, usually at the change of watch when people are moving around, but it's dark, a number of mutineers create complete chaos below deck. They scream, they make noise, they throw things, they push people around. And as they've created that chaos, they basically lock down the lower deck. They shut all the access points. They pull in some of the great guns and point them towards the quarterdeck where the officers are. And then they barricade themselves below deck with control of all the ship's weaponry. And then they make their demands. So it's sort of at that point, it's simply that now it's simply a negotiation between who has more power. And so in that sense, the British, in the British Navy, mutinies are really an expression of class warfare in an extremely literal sense. So that's kind of the sort of the patterns that develop in the different navies. And then, as I said, as the sort of two sides clash, increasingly a new form emerges, which is the sort of violent takeover mutiny, where sailors just, they don't even make demands anymore. They just rise up, kill their officers, and run away.
And there's a part of that dynamic that I thought is especially interesting and is, especially considering what happens by the end of the decade, which is how many of these crews, upon mutinying and killing their officers, then effectively defect to France. maybe not to become part of the French Navy, but to, in effect, seek the protection of the French Republic, which they see as far more sympathetic to their vision, their ideals, and of course, you know, more capable of providing them protection than if they were to simply be on their own.
Absolutely. It's a little hard to understand the motivation for defection. In some cases, there are indications that it is sort of politically motivated, and as you say, that they run to France because they see France as an alternative or as having an alternative form of government that is more closely aligned to what they want. The irony, of course, is that after the fall of the radical Jacobin Republic, French sailors themselves completely turn on the state and completely refuse to collaborate with it, even as mutineers from other navies come to France to ask to be allowed to fight for the French Republic. I think the majority probably... So in the British case, there is this huge eruption of mutinies that's bitter in the Nore, which is a kind of... a breaking point where British sailors go all out. They establish what then becomes known as the Floating Republic. It's a sort of 2 month long, basically a general strike in the home command of the British Navy, and they develop extremely sophisticated forms of political self-organization while they're at it. And this is crushed extremely violently. And after that, we can see how people just sort of flood out or flood away from Britain. They go to France, they go to the United States, they go to the Dutch Republic. And it's a sort of mishmash. In some cases, it's clear people just want to get away. In other cases, they go to France because they think this at least is closer to the political project they have in mind. And in some cases where they go to the Dutch Republic, one gets a sense that they go there because now they have an opportunity to fight against Britain. It's less that they want to sort of embrace Dutch republicanism. It's just that they have the opportunity to sort of try to strike back at Britain. So it's a mix of motivations. But what is clear is that there's a sort of sharp decline. And this is coming back to sort of my initial interest in this project, where I thought that I would see an increasing identification with the nation. The opposite is actually true, that by the late 1790s, as these wars drag on, that people become more and more disillusioned with all nations. And the general trend seems to be that they run to a place where they think they can have it slightly better, but not for really any positive identification with any nation or any political project. Though, as I said, with France, some people see this as promising politically, but the majority just want to get away.
And that gets to the dynamic you describe in your penultimate chapter, which is how the French, after the mutinies at Spithead in the Nore, try to, in effect, weaponize mutinies as a way of immobilizing the British Navy when they're thinking of conducting an invasion of Ireland. This is, of course, the Lazare Hoche and this project that ultimately is canceled in favor of Napoleon's invasion of Egypt. But you have this period in which you're describing how the French are fostering this sense of rising up, of embracing this new ideal, because they think that it will be very beneficial. And to make clear, this is after the Jacobin period. We're talking about the Directory here, but which you know could argue is much more cynical government. But they nonetheless appreciate that this is something that could really work for them, and possibly even bring them victory in this war against the British.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, at this point, of course, the French Republic has become imperialist, and then there's relatively little left over of sort of bringing liberation to peoples beyond France. But nonetheless, they're still very much in favor of revolutions in other countries among their enemies. There's also the so-called Black Legion, where that's sort of one of the projects I want to do. Look more closely that where the French basically, they just gather up a whole bunch of troublemakers, deserters, criminals, royalist renegades. They load them onto ships, take them to Wales, and just dump them there. Go forth and then spread mayhem. So they're clearly that the French are trying to do this. I think that they're a little skeptical about whether it will succeed in the Royal Navy, and it's really the Irish sort of emissaries of the United Irish who keep trying to convince the French that that their people will rise up, and And the French would like to see it, but they're also a little skeptical that it actually will happen. So which is then why, as you say, they withdraw their resources from the Atlantic coast and from the plans to sort of get to Britain through Ireland and instead favor the project of invading Egypt instead. Which, of course, is a miscalculation because right as they set sail for Egypt, the United Irish Rising erupts in Ireland and they have to scramble to get resources there. And the United Irish Rising was preceded by Irish radicals who they saw while the Great Fleet mutinies that spitted in the north were a failure from the perspective of the sailors, that they got relatively few concessions and they were cracked down upon very, very hard in its aftermath. Irish radicals looked at it and saw potential. They realized that the sort of Britain's famous wooden walls are actually quite fragile and they can be made to collapse. So for about a year after the collapse of the Fleet mutinies, the Irish are extremely active in basically establishing cells on board the Western Squadron, which is the squadron that basically patrols the seas between France and Ireland. And then they swear people in, and on several of the large ships they have sworn insurgents that number up to 50, 60, 80 people on multiple ships that basically stand ready to rise up, take over the Western Squadron, and turn it into an incipient United Irish Republican Navy. Ultimately, it fails because obviously the United Irish Rising itself fails. There's no French support that comes, but it's nonetheless a fascinating underground network at the heart of the British imperial establishment. That right under their noses, there's this really extensive Irish conspiracy and very, very active radical underground activity on board the ships of the British Navy. And what to me was especially fascinating here was that these ships are extremely crowded. One of these large warships has 600-700 men all pushed together. So it's extremely hard to, over months and months and months, to have a conspiracy to rise in violent mutiny when the day comes without most people on board ship knowing. And that includes not just the Irish, but also all the ethnically English and Scottish sailors on board those ships who all kept their mouths shut. The conspiracies only emerge, or officers only told about the Irish conspiracies, once the United Irish Rising itself has failed and it's clear that the project is not going to go anywhere. That's when suddenly people come forward and start snitching on their shipmates. So this, there is a sort of, in British historiography and in the last few decades, there has been an emphasis on kind of popular patriotism and popular loyalism during the French wars. And then the evidence from the sailors, to me, points in a very different direction, that even ethnically English sailors, they were best disinterested in the issue and whether it would be a radical Irish rising or not. They certainly weren't politically opposed to it by and large. That part is my favorite chapter, the Irish conspiracy is just so fascinating to me.
It is, and you, because you see so much at play there that you're talking about, because you talk about the Maritime Republic, and it really is this interesting concept that points to how the sailors have that commonality across race, across ethnicity, and yet by the end of the decade, nationalism becomes an increasingly more potent force among these crew members. So how is this a natural occurrence, or do the navies realize that nationalism is a potent way of pushing back against a lot of this transnational dynamic and sometimes people abandoning their allegiances in favor of this broader ideal?
I mean, I think what you see is it's a sort of, it's a combination of, after almost a decade of struggle, that has led to relatively little, except for dozens and dozens of mutineers hanging from yard arms, that there is a bitterness and disillusionment among sailors, that the sort of the insurrectionary wave has died. That combined with extremely violent repression, and I mean, I recount in the book some waves of punitive violence that are just staggering, like just horrifying. And that type of repression combined with a explicitly ethno-nationalist appeal. So we see this, for instance, very strongly when these Irish conspiracies are uncovered. The Navy establishment makes a kind of ethnically based appeal to the English sailors and basically says, you can throw in your lot with the Irish and suffer the consequences. And when we're going to demonstrate the consequences now when we're flogging someone with 500-600 lashes in front of your eyes. Or you can remember your ethnic allegiance and then you can sort of subordinate yourself to the proper hierarchies and you will be spared as long as you prove your allegiance by continuously surveying the ethnic others that serve among you. So there is this sort of appeal and this invitation for ethno-nationalist bonding combined constantly with the demonstration of what will happen to you if you don't accept the invitation. And that, I think, in the context of a failed struggle, of an almost decade-long failed struggle for improvement, is a very, very potent appeal. But I think I would distinguish that quite strongly from a kind of positive identification with the nation and with the crown in this case.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yeah, for sure. Well, right now I'm working on childcare mostly, but in terms of sort of broader projects, so one of the one reason why this book took really long to write was that after I'd found all of these mutinies, and then I'd found that they had something in common, that there was really some kind of maritime space that went beyond individual nations, and that this maritime space had a genuine revolution, a kind of genuine Atlantic revolution in the so-called Age of Atlantic Revolutions. It took me a really long time to conceptually understand what that movement was. It wasn't anti-colonial in the way, say, the Haitian Revolution was a revolution, or even the failed bid for Irish independence, or of course, like the French or American Revolution. It was something different. It took me a long time to understand that. And it was after I stumbled into an article that the brilliant French historian with the French Revolution, Pierre Cernat, wrote called Every Revolution is a War for Independence, in which he kind of reinterprets the entire Age of Revolution as basically consisting of wars for independence on different levels, that what people really are striving for is independent or right to independent politics. And once I read that, I suddenly realized that is actually what I'm seeing here. This is an attempt at a maritime war for independence. It's an attempt to undo the control of navies over maritime space, and then to reassert older traditions of how people can organize themselves on board ship and along the coasts. So this is kind of that was sort of an idea that kind of allowed me to bring this ship into harbor, but I never really articulated that or explored this fully in the book itself. So the next project I'm doing is kind of, now that I've studied the sort of attempted independence war against this form of maritime empire, so the next project is to go back and to look at how this seaborne empire was established and to sort of rethink the process of European overseas expansion as an act of colonizing maritime space. So the idea is that before overseas colonies could be established, first the seas themselves had to be colonized, beginning on the coasts in Europe themselves, and maritime space, that is a shipboard space that sort of crisscrossed the ocean. So I'm exploring this from primarily the British perspective, looking at things like the establishment of war ports like Portsmouth. I'm going to go further into the development of recruitment systems, how sort of the state lays claim to the labor of people living along the coasts. I'm going to look at things like suppression of piracy and smuggling as kind of independent forms of maritime trade and how they are sort of cracked down upon it. So that's the next project.
It sounds like a fascinating project. I really hope that when you complete it and publish it, that we can have you back on the New Books Network to discuss it.
I will do. Hopefully podcasts still exist if a project takes as long as this one. But yeah, if the internet is still a thing, I'll happily come back.
Well, hopefully it won't take that long.
I agree. I hope not.
Nicholas Frickman, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. Take care.